What does innovation sound like? It sounds like the luxury of being in the moment with your customer, client, or patient. It sounds like having the right information right when you need it. It sounds like being at your best for your customers and your business. Thanks to Hyland's intelligent content solutions that improve digital processes, innovators everywhere are able to do their thing better, whatever that thing is. Now, who doesn't like the sound of that? Hyland, for innovators everywhere. Visit Hyland.com.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
Now, next one is a really interesting study, I think. It's a story that's come out last week, and I've been talking about it myself, all about Alzheimer's. And it's a new drug's been approved, and I'm delighted to welcome Professor Sean Kennedy, the Clinical Director of the Institute of Memory and Cognition in Tele. You're very welcome, Sean, to the show.
Good morning.
Yeah. Give us this. Yeah, you're on the front line, I'm the scientist looking at the breakthroughs happening, but you're on the front line with this one. Give us the story on what's happened.
So, I mean, this is, I suppose, to put it in context, we're in a really exciting era for Alzheimer's disease in that, for, you know, the last 30 or 40 years, we really just have had medicines that can manage symptoms. And we've gone into this new era whereby we're able to make a much more accurate biological diagnosis by measuring the proteins that cause the condition. And now we've entered into this, you know, phase whereby the first medicines that are what we call disease-modifying therapies, as in medicines that we can give that will alter the trajectory of the condition, are coming true. And donanemab, none of these names are easy, but donanemab has just been licensed, and it's the second medicine that's been licensed by the Food and Drug Administration over in the US for the treatment of Alzheimer's disease. Now, it's worth pointing out, none of these medicines have yet been licensed by the European Medicines Agency, which is the next stage and the stage that's critical for their availability to, you know, in Ireland. But it's really, really positive in that the evidence and support of their efficacy and that how well they work has been shown to be supported by the Food and Drug Administration. So
all right.
Very interesting.
And it must be great for you as a doctor, because I know, say, to treat patients with Alzheimer's is extremely challenging. I mean, there are some treatments out there, I know, but to have an option must be fantastic for you, because, and to see this data emerging must be great.
Yeah, so I mean, I'm looking after people who are living with Alzheimer's disease for the last 20-25 years, and it's a great privilege to work in this area, because I suppose I get to see also the resilience of human nature. I get to see how people find a way to live well with these conditions, and that's what our most clinicians are often very fortunate to be in around. But yeah, it is, you know, there is no romanticizing the condition. It often leads to ultimately a decline in people's ability to do their day-to-day functions. And of course, memory is one of those things that's really fundamentally personal to us. It's our treasure trove of whom we are. And the thought of losing it and the thought of not having access to all those memories, of course, it impacts us more than probably any other condition.
Right.
Often the person who's living with it, though, bear in mind, and that's the thing, is we have this external view and internal view. The external view is often of a condition that's far more devastating than the person who's living with it, who probably doesn't always have the same sense of loss. So it's always around trying to see the different perspectives when you're living with it.
And this drug, I think it's called Kisunla or something, is going to be the marketing term for it. And then Leqembi's the other one, as you say.
Yeah,
these are difficult names. What do they do exactly?
So what these medicines do, well, they train the immune system, both Leqembi and Kisunla. They train the immune system to target this protein called amyloid. And amyloid is kind of considered the chief culprit protein. There's other proteins such as tau that are involved in causing Alzheimer's disease. They target amyloid and remove it from the brain. And what amyloid accumulates in the brain, believe it or not, 20 years or so before any symptoms arise. And what the evidence is emerging, and with this medicine in particular, came true in the trial, the earlier we get in. So unfortunately, these are medicines that are most useful in when given in very, very mild stages of the condition. So people with mild cognitive impairment or very, very mild dementia. So there won't be treatments for everybody. There are side effects associated with them. But what they do is they train the immune system to remove that protein amyloid from the brain and therefore slow down that cognitive decline, slow down that risk of functional loss.
So it's not a cure, obviously.
It's not a cure. It's a bit like, I suppose, I kind of used the analogy for HIV in that we never had technically any cures for HIV. But what these are is the first medicines, the first chemotherapies. The future of Alzheimer's disease is beginning to look a little bit like we consider, you know, cancer care now. And, you know, to a certain extent, we're going to be looking at the first Alzheimer's oncologists who are coming through to deliver these medicines.
And the slowing down, the clinical trial obviously revealed this, the ones on the drug, they had slower progression, did they? How much would it slow down by?
So this is, I mean, so over the course of the trial, so the trial ran for about 18 months, but actually what, for Kisunla, it was in a, you know, a trial where they measured the clearance of the protein. So actually some people had cleared the protein by 12 months, over three quarters had cleared it by the 18 months. And what it showed was it probably over the 18-month period reduced the risk of progression by about 4.5 to 7.5 months. So about a 6 month just over that 18-month period. Now, we don't know how that maps forward. So let's say we don't know, you know, there's further studies going on following those cohorts for longer to see whether we get an amplification of that effect or whether it's, if you like, a once-off while you're on the medicine, you have this effect. But already, if we take the first Leqembi, there's new approvals gone back in for more longitudinal or longer term treatment. And also these are drips. So these are infusion based medicines. There's now actually approvals going through for what we call subcut or injection medicines, which would really radically, you know, change the difficulty in administering these medicines for patients.
Right. And then the side effects, because inevitably with any new medicine, any medicines at all, the side effects of some kind, and they were reported, weren't they, as part of the trial?
Yeah, I mean, it's important to consider these medicines like we would chemotherapies for oncology, and that there are some serious side effects. And in fact, through the trials in both these medicines, several people have died. What happens, unfortunately, this protein amyloid, when it builds up in the brain, it builds up in blood vessels. And when we remove it from the brain, these blood vessels can get leaky. So it's a bit like, you know, the cement between the blocks ultimately gets disentangled and you get these leaks. For nearly 90% of those cases, it's asymptomatic. It's not a big deal. But there's about 10% whereby people may get symptoms such as headache, feel nauseous, and they'll need to come off the treatment for a period of time. These are called ARIAs. And these are going to be the main side effects associated with these medicines. And for some people, they cause these bleeds in the brain. Ultimately, the blood vessels lost their integrity and they caused these little bleeds in the brain. So there are, picking the right people, we know there were some genetic risks that predicted who was most likely to get these side effects. So we're probably going to have to look at the genes of certain people to identify the APOE4 gene people were the people who are more likely to get these side effects.
Right.
So stratifying whom is most suitable for these medicines is going to be really, really key.
But it's complicated enough, isn't it, in a way? So not everybody will respond, you're saying, in a sense. And then if you can pick the people who will respond, that's going to be very useful, I would think. And then also diagnosis is going to be very important, is it, John? Because as you said, the earlier you get it, the better. Is that right?
So and we've got huge advances in diagnosis happening at the moment. Okay, so at the moment in my clinic, I have to do a lumbar puncture where I measure these proteins. And we do about 200, 250 of those a year, whereby we look at the little sample of fluid from the lower spine. But actually quickly and over the next year or two, there's going to be available blood-based biomarkers that does the same. So from a blood test, we'll be able to identify, and in particular, we'll be able to identify whom it is we might want to go do the more detailed scans that we want to do or that lumbar puncture. So actually blood tests may actually help us an awful lot in triaging out who might be the more suitable people with mild symptoms for these agents.
Now, John McClare McKenna now, who is a presenter on News Talks Alive. And Claire, you're very welcome. And I believe you've got a personal experience because your dad sadly passed away 4 years ago at the age of 82 with vascular dementia. His name was Patrick McKenna. So can you tell us, what do you make of this breakthrough?
Well, I think it will help a lot of families because you do feel quite helpless to watch your loved one decline in that way. And as Sean said, when you can only have medication to manage the symptoms as opposed to really have an impact on them. But it's still a very tough thing to go through regardless. I mean, anybody who's lost a loved one through any illness, I know it's difficult, but myself and my mum have long debated this now after going through it with Dad. What do we feel is better, to have a sort of a physical ailment at the end of your life where you still have your cognitive function and can still communicate with your loved ones, or something more like Dad went through where his body was able but his mind wasn't? And, you know, I think we're more veering towards, look, everyone wants to die peacefully in their sleep, but to have your cognitive function and your memories and your communication with your loved ones, I think, is so important.
Absolutely. And how tough was it there? He was suffering, obviously, but as Sean was saying, very often the person with the ailment isn't necessarily aware of it.
Well, it's a long decline, you know. My dad had a couple of strokes, so he had what's called vascular dementia. So they were sort of connected in some way. There was damage caused by the strokes, particularly to his memory functions. But it will happen over a period of maybe even 7-8 years. There was a time he was going to come down to an allotment I had to help me one evening. We live about an 8-10 minute drive from each other. Obviously, I'd lived in the house for a number of years. He knew it really well. And I was wondering why he was running late, and he was lost. He eventually rang my mum and I went and found him, and he was in a close by industrial estate. And when I found him, he wasn't in a confused state or anything, but he was very much himself, but thinking, God, what? I don't know what came over me there. I don't know what happened. And that's sort of like a step one all the way down to, you know, how it went. And that will go away then. He'll go back to normal for, you know, a good bit of time. But there are little markers along the way.
Right, yeah. And how did you manage yourself, Claire, with this? Because it is, as we all know, the relatives, you know, it's very sort of disturbing. How did you cope?
Well, our steady decline was through COVID, because it kind of came in tandem with that, unfortunately. So with the lack of socialising and him and my mum sort of cocooning away, that's when things got really tough. And my mum was really struggling. And of course, this was in the height of the fear and anxiety. And we were sort of dropping bags of shopping at the door, dressed pretty much in hazmat suits and leaving. And eventually my mum had to sort of say, I'm going to need more support. So as a family is how we coped. I was really very lucky that I have a very close family. We communicate really well, my brother, my sister, and doing it together and sharing it out and constantly communicating was amazing, as were the Alzheimer's Society. I rang them so many times. There was a lady called Joanne there who was so helpful. She would advise me on what to say, you know, if we were going to a medical appointment. Myself and my sister did the family carers online course, because there's loads of things you don't know, like not to argue with them when they say they need to go home to their mother, or not to try and tell them that you're at home. Just little tips and tricks like that that we learned along the way. So they were big helps.
Yeah, I've heard that. They're a wonderful organisation, apparently, and provide huge support to relatives and, of course, the sufferers as well. So you'd be a fan of the Alzheimer's Society. And they have made a statement about this themselves, saying this is a really important advance in a way, you know. But that's very important, isn't it, for relatives of people to get support. And you reckon the Alzheimer's Society is the place to go?
Yeah, and it was online. I don't know if they do it in person, or I don't know whether it was COVID related that is the way it was. But you'd see other families and other people, you know. And I still think of a woman in her 40s who, you know, was coming on with very young kids, and it was her husband. And, you know, she didn't show up again, because I imagine her life was just chaotic. And you do think of people like that. I still think about that family, and to be able to connect with other people going through what you're going through, I think is really important. But I mean, I think I should also say, because it was the pandemic, I was very grateful that my working life and, you know, my kids' lives and everything really slowed down. So I got to spend a lot of one-on-one time with my dad, and I got to really be there. So I'm very grateful for that in many ways.
Right. And Sean, do you think the future of this, then, this will get approved in Europe, I imagine, do you think?
I suppose, fingers crossed. I wouldn't preempt any of those decisions. So, I mean, the UK and the European agencies are looking at these at the moment. But yeah, hopefully.
Hopefully it will be, yeah. And I guess the EMA, as we speak, I think, are looking at, they can be the first one.
That's the main one, yeah.
And then what about cost? That's the next question.
They're expensive medicines over in the US at the moment. It's around $27,000 per year as a treatment. But when we look at if we just look across Ireland, we look at InformaCare, and yet again, just to reiterate, the Alzheimer's Society are a fantastic society, and their dementia carers, which we link in with, you know, quite regularly, are absolutely fantastic resource for signposting people in the community, and really would encourage people to engage. And it's been a fantastic organization for us to work with as professionals. But if we look at the informal costs supporting people with dementia, it's about $1.5 billion per year, between formal and informal costs of supporting the care of people with dementia. So you can imagine that any significant impact that we can make on that, if we can reduce. So the idea is that these aren't medicines that help you think better. These are medicines that reduce your risk of having a fall. These are medicines that reduce your risk of ending up in a nursing home. These are risks that will, you know, enable you to remain an active participant within the workforce, because we look after people who are, you know, about 10% of people who develop Alzheimer's disease are under the age of 65 and are still working.
Right.
So there's, you know, Alzheimer's disease isn't something that just affects people.
No.
you know, who are older. It also affects younger people, as we've just heard.
Right, and I know the incidence is going up, isn't it, Jonas? Another, we need medicines more than ever for this, don't we? Because I believe they're the case of it. Did you see this yourself, the more and more cases?
Yeah, so I mean, I think what's happening is people are far more aware and they realise it's a biological condition, so stigma is less. So people are coming forward better, but I think also what's happening is with an ageing population, it's about trying to match health span and if you like, lifespan. So what we've been really successful at now is elongating lifespan. We're all living longer, but what we need to make sure now is that we live healthy as long as we're living. And there's about 7 or 8 years mismatch between health span and lifespan. Right. And dementia probably accounts for that, the biggest amount of that. So that's right. Where these medicines really potentially come in, is they elongate health span.
Very good. Well, Sean, thank you very much for coming in. That's Sean Kennelly, Clinical Director of the Institute of Memory and Cognition in Tala. And also Claire, thanks ever so much, Claire, for sharing your thoughts on your dad from Alive and Kicking on News Talk. And it is a good story, this, in my opinion, because now we have options, as Sean was saying. Two new drugs may be available for Sean to offer his patients in the future. So thanks to both of you.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
At Highland, we're all about celebrating little wins and little ways to innovate digital processes. There's no customer pain point too small for us to help with. Maybe that's why more than half of the Fortune 100 looks to Highland to connect their content and data, improve processes, and turn little efficiencies into big wins for their customers and clients. Highland, intelligent content solutions for innovators everywhere at highland.com.